Okay, so this is now recording. Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and move into the next paper at this stage. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Ong Si from Australian National University, who will be talking to us today about ethnobiology and language documentation.
Thank you. Yeah, so I'll be talking to you today about how documenting ethnobiological knowledge can become a very integral part of any language documentation project, and how by documenting this sort of information, we can end up with a very rich corpus that's relevant and valuable not only to the speech community, but also to other academics in different fields. My research is funded by the Australian National University. I'm a PhD student there, and also by the Endangered Languages Project, Hans-Rausing Endangered Languages Project. So my field site is in southern India, just outside the big urban center of Bangalore. So it's 5 hours outside that city. The language community I'm working with are called the Soliga. Even people in Bangalore haven't heard of them, so don't feel bad if you haven't. And there's Ethnologue estimates that there are about 30,000 Soliga speakers, as compared to 30 million Kannada speakers, which is the state language of the state of Karnataka. So there's a very strong imbalance, not only in terms of population size, but also in a socioeconomic way as well. Just for the record, my family is from Burma, Rangoon. I grew up in New Delhi, now based in Australia. So I'm sort of a local, but mostly I'm an outsider in the community as well. So like in many other parts of the world, there's very strong language attrition from Soliga towards Kannada, because young people are listening to Kannada music. There's big mobile telephone towers going up in the middle of the forest. People are moving to the cities for jobs, and the language, and especially traditional cultural knowledge, is not being transmitted to younger generations. Oh, also, I should mention that I have a biology background, but don't let that put you off, because I think anyone can do this kind of work. You don't need a biology degree for this. Biologically, this field site is very interesting because it's at the intersection of two very important mountain ranges, the Eastern and Western Ghats, which are isolated for most of their range. They just meet in this one small area, and that's why this part of India, which is called the Nilgiri Hills, has been considered a biodiversity hotspot by many conservation agencies like the WWF. The Soliga themselves, I guess you could call them a society in flux. Some of the old ways are still maintained. Their religion isn't really mainstream Hinduism, it's more animist, but with very strong mainstream Hindu undertones. Their most sacred site, for example, is this very impressive looking single tree in the middle of the forest. They still perform festivals to their old gods, which are not known outside the community. And yet, if you go into an average Soliga house nowadays, you will see representations of Hindu gods and goddesses, which would be recognized anywhere in the country. And like I said, you know, people are getting more urbanized, moving out of the community into the cities to find jobs and so on. It's a bit of a cliche, but they really have a very close connection with what we in the West would call nature. So, you know, they have lots of song cycles that they have to sing at every important religious festival. Each stanza would be about a single mammal or a bird species that's found in the forest. And by singing that in front of the temple or the shrine, they basically elevate that animal to the status of a divinity almost. Ecologically as well, it's quite diverse. You find a whole range of habitat types, everything from, you know, open grassland on mountain slopes to deciduous forests to sort of Australian style scrub forest that's quite dry, all the way to moist, cool, evergreen rainforest. So to start off with, a little bit about what ethnobiology actually, what I mean by ethnobiology, because it can mean many different things to many people. I guess at a fundamental level, it can be collecting names of plants and animals. You really need that to move ahead, I guess, and developing folk taxonomies. It can be talking about the relationships between biological entities and the mythology and the culture of that language group. And this is exemplified by the work of Ralph Bulmer, an Australian anthropologist who's done a lot of work on Karam in Papua New Guinea. It can be about the use of a particular resource, for example, you know, Roy Ellen's work on the use of sago, the harvesting, the cultivation, and the utilization of sago in eastern Indonesia, for example. They can be descriptions of landscape and how people interact with the landscape. So, for example, Murray Gard and his work on the ecology of fire as practiced by the inhabitants of Arnhem Land in northern Australia. And of course, there can be applied aspects of ethnobiological knowledge. So this can be something like a fisheries manager going to local fishing villages, asking people about the names of the fish that they catch, and also how much they catch, so that an estimate can be made of the sustainability of a certain resource. So why should linguists or people who do documentation, I guess, worry about biological knowledge, and how is this relevant? Well, I guess the most obvious answer is it is often very relevant to the daily life of the language speakers themselves, especially the ones who live far away from urban communities. It's reasonably easy to elicit this kind of information if you ask the right questions, and people are quite happy to talk about these kinds of issues. From personal experience, they're definitely a lot happier doing this than they are doing grammatical stuff, for example. You can really get a range of speech genres in your corpus by just focusing on this one semantic domain. So you can ask a group of people to identify a certain plant in the forest, and you can end up with quite a heated discussion about what that plant is, which features should be looked at. No, you idiot, you're wrong. That sort of very naturalistic conversation, I guess. You can get that. You can get people to describe a certain landscape type. So what do you get when you go into this landscape, or you find these trees, and you can get little stories about how someone went there and was attacked by a bear or whatever. All the way to very ritualistic language, like I mentioned, the religious ritual language that deals with certain animals from the forest. And yes, by looking at this semantic domain, you can really end up with a very rich and very elaborate corpus of material. So the first thing, obviously, that needs to be looked at is the lexicon, the biological lexicon in a language. This is really important because often a significant chunk of the lexicon for a non-urban community will relate to biological phenomena and entities. So in the language that I'm working with, Soliga, there are at least 400 different plant names, 20 different forest or landscape types, about 100 bird names, 40 mammal names, about 15 vertebrates. This is not unusual. It's quite standard for what you might call a hunter-gatherer population, for example. It is arguably the most threatened part of the lexicon in many communities. There might be counter examples to this, but at least in the communities I know about that I've read about, because of a whole range of factors like lifestyle change or climate change, the entities that these words refer to are no longer being found in the forest. And obviously, if you don't find something in the forest, you don't talk about it to your children, and that sort of knowledge gets lost very easily, right? So at my field site, there's this invasive species called Lantana, which is a woody weed. It's quite thorny. I think it's a bit of a problem in Hawaii as well. And it's one of the top 10 woody weeds around the world. And it basically takes over everything. And you get these really high, dense bushes and thickets that completely cover all the native grasses, all the native understory. And basically you just get large old forest trees and Lantana and nothing else. Even the old forest trees can't reproduce anymore because their seeds won't germinate, because the ground is entirely covered by Lantana. Another point is that the lexicon, at least for this language situation, is the main source of difference between Soliga and its much more powerful neighbor, Kannada. And that sounds like a strange thing to say, but it really is quite relevant in this context because, to put it bluntly, Kannada speakers don't take Soliga very seriously. it's a bit of a, you know, it's a mountain dialect up there. They don't speak proper Kannada. And so the attitudes are often quite negative, or, well, not positive anyway. And so by listing lexical differences between the two languages, the grammars are really quite close, I'll give it that. But this, for example, wouldn't exist in Kannada at all. So you have a whole range of forest types and landscape types. A Kannada speaker, if you took someone who spoke Kannada to these places, they might distinguish between mountain forest versus plains forest. But that's about the level of distinction you get. The Kannada lexicon, the Solika lexicon, in contrast, has a much more fine-grained distinction of forest types encoded in it. You can look at things like the names of, well, the names of rains, but you could call them seasons as well. There are some overlap between the Kannada and Solika names, but there are some things that are just missing. Oh, you probably can't read it, but this is Taragu Kadiyaka. Two early rains that fall in February and March. And these are ecologically very important because that's when the Solika would traditionally light leaf litter fires in the forest. This practice has now been banned by the State Forest Department. And the Solika blame that for the spread of lantana in the forest, in fact, because they said that by clearing the forest every single dry season, you would get rid of all the new sprouting weeds and everything, make room for grasses to grow again, make room for the seeds of rainforest trees to germinate, and the whole forest to regenerate. And these terms are missing in Kannada, for instance. In case you're thinking to yourself that they all pretty much look the same, I would say look at the tusk morphology, the way the size of the tusk, the orientation, and also the overall shape, I guess. So these are words that are used quite routinely by Solika speakers. So when they say, I was walking through the forest looking for honey and I encountered an elephant, they'll often say, oh, I saw a Poktilubomba, for instance, which means cradle tusk, which means a very mature tusker with tusks that are so big they point out and curve up as well. Or you can say Kloriana, which is an old female that's just starting to sprout anomalous tusks, I guess. Right. And whether the tusks meet in front or whether they cross over, and whether one's missing and so on. Again, you know, Kannada might have something like equivalent to the English tusker versus non-tusker or something. But of course, the lexicon is more than just a word list. And to make your lexical data meaningful, you really need a whole bunch of paralinguistic data, such as photographs and, you know, cultural information, known ecological links. Ecological links that are known to the community, not to Western science, right? And a scientific ID also helps if you want to make that information relevant to other researchers. So, you know, in a lot of dictionaries, you will see this kind of entry, Dorlimara, kind of rainforest tree. I'm guilty of this as well. You know, you often see something by the roadside that's half eaten, and your language consultant goes, oh, we call that such and such. There's not much you can do except list the word and say it's kind of lizard or whatever. But in most cases, you can, you know, get some nice photographs. There's no reason why this should be any difficult nowadays. Here, I've taken a series of four photographs: one showing the overall habit of the tree, one showing the leaves, one showing a close-up of the flower. Flower is really very important if you want to get this ID by a botanist. And the last picture shows a bit of bark damage done by an elephant, so that's sort of ecologically relevant. And once you have this kind of information, it's not very hard to get that scientific ID, either from a field guide or with the help of a botanist. And of course, none of this exists in vacuum. Whenever a language consultant IDs something, he or she will often give you a whole bunch of relevant cultural ecological information. So that's also quite important. But when you're talking about ecological knowledge, of course, that's, again, more than just the lexicon. So I have a recording where I asked an elder to describe this landscape term, Oddugaru, which is this kind of thing with a whole bunch of boulders piled on top of each other. It's quite bare of any large rainforest trees. And in the space of 2 minutes, it's a little short little two-minute recording, he lifts not just the physical description of the place, so, you know, a whole bunch of boulders. He provided place names where you would find that sort of thing. He named local plants and animals that are sort of local to that kind of landscape type. So that'd be bears, tigers, porcupines, and this kind of plant. He talked about resource use. I was going there to collect a particular kind of honey. That's when I got attacked by the bear, for example. Cultural information. So this is the kind of things that his elders would tell him when he was young. Don't go to this place because there's bears. But he went anyway. Because the honey was good, I guess. You can get some very fine-grained knowledge of animal behavior. Elephants are obviously very prominent in the landscape. But because of the lantana that's covering everything now, these bushes can be so high that they will obscure an elephant that's standing right behind it. So you can be walking along a path and... It sounds weird, but you can just stumble upon an elephant accidentally. And obviously that's very dangerous. Yeah? So these are the kinds of signs that you would have to look out for. If you're in the forest looking for yams or for honey, and you want to avoid elephants. And this is also a nice example of new knowledge. So the lantana is quite a recent phenomenon that's arrived in the forest in the last 40 years. But already they've started talking about these kinds of issues. Because obviously it's very relevant to their everyday life. So it doesn't necessarily have to be what the elders knew. It can be very new, very relevant, very current information as well. This is just me asking one speaker on the 26th of March, what is the forest doing right now? And basically I got a whole list of tree names. This is just free recall. And the speaker would say, the Matti tree is currently bare, it's barulu. The Honne tree currently is sprouting new leaves. The Utare tree is currently, has got flowers. And so just with that one very simple question, you can get a whole list of very complex ecological knowledge. And of course you could do this every single month of the year and the picture would change, right? So you get an overall picture of what the forest is doing over the period of 1 year. And because this sort of knowledge is so internalized for all, practically all adult speakers, they often use this kind of calendar to talk about other events that happen throughout the year. They don't use the English calendar of months. Their rain calendar of months is not very well known, but this kind of thing is very well internalized. And so they'll often say, the giant honeybee arrives in the forest at the time when the Honne tree is in flower, which is sometime in April. So these ecological links between animal behavior or animal migration patterns on the one hand and what the forest is doing, these links are very, very clear in their minds. And finally, I would say that it's very important to avoid biases. Especially if you do have a training in biological training. I'm there to, as I see it, to document indigenous knowledge. I'm not there to translate Western scientific concepts into the local language, right? So there's this kind of forest type that's called Kanukadu. And the biologists who work at this field site will often just gloss that as evergreen forest. Evergreen being, you know, a forest where the trees don't lose their leaves. And that contrasts with deciduous forest. But if you ask a native speaker to talk about what Kanukadu is, they will list all these things, but never once do they say that this is the kind of forest where the trees don't lose their leaves, right? So by glossing Kanukadu as evergreen forest, you are very much biasing the semantics away from indigenous semantics to Western semantics. So it's something to watch out for. Yeah, so I guess my point here is it really is quite important to... All communities are quite different, of course, so this might not apply everywhere. But I would like to make a strong case for the fact that... For the point that it's very important to document traditional biological knowledge because in many cases it is the most threatened part of the spoken language. More important than that, it is also part of the spoken language that is considered by native speakers to be highly relevant to their lives and to their culture. And therefore, this kind of language documentation could easily be made a priority in many documentation projects. Of course, I'm not saying that people who are interested in other things like song or writing grammar should drop what they're doing and just move to this. This biological knowledge is just one way of opening many doors into the speech community and getting them interested in work collaborating with you. And I think by doing so, you will really end up with a very rich corpus that's of use to a whole range of people.